Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. How are you? How are the cookies? It's always good to have cookies in the afternoon, right? Well, it's my pleasure to be here, and today I'm going to be talking about American agriculture. Now, while you might consider yourself ranchers and looking at the beef cattle deal, today we're going to broaden our focus a little bit as we talk about American agriculture, our most noble endeavor. Scott. But before I do, I have to tell you, I hope I can do it a little better than I did with one of my former students. You see, when I started my career as an ag teacher back in the day, and Daryl, you'll appreciate this, I was over in Chowchilla, California. I coached the livestock judging team. And we were very competitive. We won contests all over California. And kids were excited about being on the livestock team. But on this one particular occasion, we were getting ready for the contest at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. If you've ever been there, back in the day, that was a big deal to go to the Cow Palace in San Francisco. But I had this one student. His name was Billy. Billy come up to me, and he you could just see it. You could just see it. He was nervous as could be. He goes, Billy, go ahead. Mr. Bernard, I don't think I can go. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, you know, Cow Palace is a big deal. I'm just a freshman. I said, Billy, it's easy, it's easy. You'll be fine. I don't know. Maybe I ought to wait. And so the teacher in me took over, and I began the Socratic method of asking questions so that he could discover himself. That's what I was taught in college. That's what I thought I'd do with Billy. And so I began to ask him a few questions. I said, Billy, I said, you come from one of the best limousine ranches in the Central Valley, don't you?
Yes, sir.
I said, you and your daddy travel all over the place buying bulls and heifers and doing all that, don't you?
Yes, sir.
I said, and you go to the big shows and you're very competitive at the shows and you just know what you're doing.
Yeah.
I said, well, then, Billy, look, it's really pretty easy. All you have to do when you get to Cow Palace, when you get on those classes and you begin to start evaluating them, just place them like you and your daddy would buy them.
Okay.
And so we go up to the Cow Palace, and Billy's on the team, and I turn them loose on the contest, and they come back, and they all write down how they placed them so we could take a look and kind of get a preview before the results to see how they did. Well, Billy handed me his sheet, and there's one class of Hereford Bulls. I look at that thing, and I said, Billy, what the heck were you thinking? I said, you placed this class completely backwards. I said, didn't you see that number one bull? That number one bull would be the best bull in a lot of people's herd, would be a herd sire, easy money. I said, and then he sell that bull ought to be worth $200,000, $250,000. How could you put him last?
He began to cry. Mr. Vernon, I'm just doing what you told me.
I said, what are you talking about, Billy?
He says, you told me to place him like me and my daddy'd buy him, and I knew we couldn't afford him, so I put him last.
Sometimes we outsmart ourselves. Oh, Billy. Billy went on to have a good career in judging, and we had a good time. But I hope that I can communicate with you a little better today than I did with Billy back in the day. Scott, as we look at agriculture and we look at what is it that we're doing, what is it we're doing as a profession, what is it we're doing day to day, and we look at, you know, the future oftentimes is predicated on what we've done in the past. And so I'm going to rely today on some scholars and some statesmen that certainly know a lot more than I do. You know, history sometimes tells us where the future will go. And sometimes it's challenging because, as Daniel Webster said, let us not forget that the cultivation of earth is the most important labor of man. When tillage begins, other arts will follow. The farmers, therefore, are the founders of our civilization. And so, in part, I'm here to say thank you. Thank you for what you do. Thank you for being who you are. And while you would consider yourselves ranchers, and I know fully well the difference between a rancher and a farmer, you're all part of cultivating the earth. And some of you farm, you might raise some hay and some beans, some corn, whatever it might be. But we have to understand, where's our place in civilization? I think Daniel Webster captured it brilliantly, that without what you do, Nothing else matters. I often say that because of the success of American agriculture, we can have lots of problems. People look at me and go, what are you talking about? I said, yes, because we're so successful at what we do, we can have lots of problems. Because if you don't have, as a nation, a successful agriculture and a way to provide food to your citizens, you have one problem: food. Because of American agriculture, we have a bounty of food. We have food independence in this nation. And the scary part is, if we're not careful and we lose our food independence, that's when we begin to lose the civilization as we know it. And so we must take our education of the past and move it to the future. It's critical that we remain a food independent nation. And that's what you do each and every day. You work to provide food for our country and countries around the globe. Scott? George Washington, our founding father, it was not lost on him the importance of agriculture. And if you ever have an opportunity to visit his farm in Alexandria, Mount Vernon, you'll see that he too cared about agriculture. Agriculture is the most healthful, most useful, and most noble employment of man. He valued agriculture and was very innovative. If you go to his farm there at Mount Vernon, you see how he was able to manage his operation and to employ new techniques at the founding of our country. You see, agriculture and its importance wasn't lost on smart people like Daniel Webster and George Washington. But I'm afraid today that as we look ahead, our task is large, because people take their food for granted. 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. If you want something to eat, it will be available to you. And it will be healthy, it will be affordable, and it will be abundant. But it's at risk. It's at risk for those who don't know what we're doing. Scott? It's a new, crazy world out there. You're having to conduct business in a world that's rapidly changing. We've heard the speaker say that today. The world is changing. When we consider being, you know, when we look at the digital world and the rapid pace of change that brings upon us, you, like me, are digital immigrants. The future is based on digital natives. As Eric talked about the young people, hire that shaggy-headed kid, that's a digital native. They're used to that language in a digital world. For us, with a little age on us, we're digital immigrants. We're having to learn a new language. And in some cases, we don't want to. They didn't know. I built a successful business, do it my way, this is the way I'm going to do it. Well, the world is changing. I'll show you this quick clip. Scott? This is the dialogue that's going on all over.
Find me that bag the other day.
Come on. It's more for me than you.
God, you have beautiful eyes.
Everyone tells me that.
I'm the only one that told you that.
No, I don't mean like in a flirty way. But people, as when I was a kid, like, you got great eyes. And it's like, I'm just a guy.
You're my guy.
I am your guy.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hi, hello.
My name is Dana. I'll be taking care of you today. If you have any questions about the menu, please let me know.
I guess I do have a question about the chicken, if you could just tell us a little bit more about it.
The chicken is a heritage breed, woodland-raised chicken that's been fed a diet of sheep's milk, soy, and hazelnuts.
Okay, this is local?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to ask you just one more time, and it's local.
It is.
Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic?
It's just all across the board organic.
The hazelnuts, these are local?
How big is the area where the chickens are able to roam free?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have exactly the same question.
4 acres. Mm-hmm. Give me just a second. I'll be right back, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Great.
She's nice.
We're doing the right thing.
I'm too apologetic.
You are.
I drove way too slow here today, didn't I?
Yeah.
I am so weird with that gas pedal. The thing just moves the whole vehicle forward. And
all right. So here is the chicken you'll be enjoying tonight.
You have this information. This is fantastic.
Absolutely. His name was Colin. Here are his papers, okay?
That's great.
He looks like a happy little guy who runs around.
A lot of friends, other chickens as friends. Putting his little wing around another one and kind of like palling around.
I don't know that I can speak to that level of intimate knowledge about him. They do a lot to make sure that their chickens are very happy.
When you say they, I mean, who are these people raising Colin?
It's a farm that's located about 30 miles south of Portland.
And you have a good relationship with this farm?
We do.
It's not some guy on a yacht who lives in Miami saying that he's organic.
It tears at the core of my being the idea of someone just cashing in on a trend like organic.
No, I know the type. No.
Yeah,
tell you what, we're going to go check it out if you don't mind. If you could just hold our seats.
Oh, now?
Yeah. We'll, we'll be right back. We'll just want to make sure it.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dana.
Sure.
Okay, Scott. So there you have it. That conversation is going on in restaurants all across America. Perhaps not where you eat, but where many people do. The white tablecloths of our restaurants, they're asking these kinds of questions. And while this was a chicken deal, we can throw the chickens under the bus. That's all right. We're among cattlemen. But they're asking the same thing about our beef. They want to know more about the food that they eat. And so as we look to the future, as we look ahead, we have to think, how will we best tell that story of where their food came from? And ultimately, you have to think beyond your intermediate customer, the commercial cow-calf guy, and into the retail side of it as well. Because that's the kind of information that they're wanting. Now, as you travel the country and as I travel the country, and I'll agree with Debbie, this is at the top end of the food chain. These are people who are affluent, who have the ability to pay more for their food, but they're driving the conversations that we're having about our food and impacting families all over America. Now, as I travel the country and take the back roads and eat at local dives and diners, I don't see that same kind of conversation. And when I go into Walmarts of the world and you see the volume of people going into Walmart, that's not these people. But they're still trying to make sound food purchasing decisions, and they're getting bombarded with this kind of information. This came from a show called Portlandia, which is a satire comedy, obviously, and over the top. But it's not far from what we see happening all over the place. And certainly, being from California, you know, out there on the left coast, we see a lot of fruits and nuts. Some are even on trees. And some will just hug the tree and hang out there. And then you're here in New York, and change happens on the edges, the extremes. And what happens is you'll begin to see pressure pushing its way to the middle of this country. And so what goes on in California, what goes on here on the East Coast, affects you in the heart of America as well. And so we have to consider, what's the future if this is where the dialogue goes. And I'm reminded of a story of Wayne Gretzky, and perhaps you know Wayne Gretzky was a Hall of Fame hockey player, absolutely one of the best ever put on a pair of skates. And when they were inducting him to the Hall of Fame, someone asked him, he said, Wayne, how did you get so good at what you do? What makes you so much better than everybody else? And what he said was profound. He said, most everybody in the game skates to where the puck is. I skate to where the puck will be. It's that level of anticipation that made Wayne Gretzky so good. And so as you try to synthesize all the information that you're gathering here today, I think one of the important messages is, as you look to the future, is go home and say, where is the puck going for me and our family and our operation? And then prepare today for where that puck will be next week, next year, next generation. We heard today, you know, from Kip about family planning and succession and how to hand it down. We had some questions about that. What are you doing today to ensure the next generation's success in succession planning? Are you doing it in a thoughtful, non-pressurized way? Don't wait till somebody dies to have that discussion, because people won't think rationally. Instead, have that discussion today on where will you be in the future with your operation. Those are the kinds of dialogues that we need to have. Scott? One of my idols as a scholar was George Washington Carver. He said, when you can do the common things in life in an uncommon way, it is then you will command the attention of the world. And when you look at our nation, a lot of people think what we do is common. We're farmers and ranchers. It can't be that difficult. But they've never had to grow their own food. But you know that it is a very difficult task to do it efficiently, effectively, profitably. Those are the kinds of discussions that the future holds for us. It's interesting to me that George Washington Carver was born a slave, a graduate of Iowa State University, and ultimately went to Tuskegee and worked with Booker T. Washington there at Tuskegee Institute. And here is a black man born into slavery developing technologies and science dealing with legumes and nitrogen-fixing plants, peanuts, that ultimately helped to resurrect the South. If you remember in history what happened in the South, it was cotton production, cotton, cotton, cotton. And cotton takes a lot from the soil. But as a legume, peanuts put nitrogen back into the soil. And so here's a man who forgot his past. He recognized and was aware, but he looked to the future. How would the South survive without science and technology? And that's what you're doing, implementing science and technology on your operations. Genetically, technologically, the science is moving things forward. And as Eric talked about, the information age. Today you have at your fingertips more information than ever before in the history of mankind. How do you use the information? That becomes part of your management and leadership decision-making process. George Washington Carver was an amazing, amazing teacher. He took the information and spread it all across the South as part of his extension service, if you will. As seed stock producers, you have that same obligation. You're at the top of the beef production pyramid. Producers, commercial cow-calf guys, depend on you at the top of that pyramid to have the latest, the greatest, the best information, the best genetics, the best science available to you so that you can help them develop their operations as well. And so as seed stock producers, you have to ask yourself, are we doing that? Are we staying on the edge so that we can do more with less? Those are the questions that you really have to ask about your future. And many of you are. But some of you might be resting on your laurels of past. And if you're not careful, the world will pass you by. It's going at a tremendously fast pace. George Washington Carver, as a teacher, had an impact on his students. And I want to tell you a story about this one student, Scott. Jimmy. Little Jimmy Smith, born into a big family, African-American kid, poor as dirt. Poor as dirt, and when he went to school, they said, oh, Jimmy, you're educationally handicapped, you'll never be successful. And to compound matters, Jimmy had a condition on his arm that would cause it to swell to 2 and 3 times its normal size. He would end up dragging it along his side like a club. But the one thing that people didn't give Jimmy credit for was this huge smile that he always had. Jimmy could always smile. He smiled big. He was excited about life. When everything in life says, you should not be excited. Poor. Borderline mentally retarded. Physically disabled. But yet, here he was. Smiling every day. And you know what made Jimmy smile the most? Animals. Animals made Jimmy smile. And so when he got to high school, he joined the FFA. And FFA, being the wonderful organization that it is, it accepts everybody. And Jimmy came into the organization, and with his one arm that would swing around,
I want to have a steer. And the ag teachers facilitated through the bank a loan to get Jimmy a steer. This was in the fall of the year. So he had a steer, and he loved that calf. He loved that calf. But yet, early fall, he went back to the doctor. He got to the doctor's office, and his arm had flamed up, and now you could not even recognize his fingers. And the doctor looked at him and his family and said, Jimmy, we're at the end of our rope. We have nothing else that we can do for you and your arm. And so they made a tough decision that fall morning to amputate. And so they amputated his arm. And if a kid wasn't handicapped to begin with, he was even more so now. They bandaged it up. He came out of the hospital and returned to school. He kept his steer at the school farm. And he would go out to that school farm, and he would rinse his calf and brush and brush and brush. He brushed more with one arm than privileged kids with two could ever do. He loved his calf. He loved animals and he loved agriculture. And you could not take that away from him. As he was preparing for the fair that spring, he would lead his calf around and the other kids began to rally around Jimmy. They began to rally around him because they too saw the connection with the animals. Jimmy, in a way, became their leader, almost by default. Jimmy had never been to the fair before. He didn't know what it was all about. But he knew, historically, that kids had fun when they went to the fair. Seemed like a good thing to do. And so there they prepared and they went to the spring fair. Jimmy began to take his calf out into the ring. And he was showing his calf, and he practiced, but again, let's remember, he was mentally challenged. And so as he would walk around, he would get distracted and look outside the ring. Jimmy, watch the calf. Watch the judge. And he would focus back in. And so as he would walk around the ring, there'd be people positioned to remind him to look at the judge. He was having a big time, had a big smile on his face. Oh man, it was amazing to see that morning. The first class, he wins the class. So now he's going to go back. Goes back, and now it's in the FFA division. He won his class, and now they're going to pick a champion. Lo and behold, Jimmy wins the FFA champion. And then that evening was the final drive, picking supreme champion against the 4-H and the FFA. And again, there was Jimmy. But now things had begun to change. People from town became interested. They heard the story, and this was a small town of Chowchilla, only 3,000, 4,000 at the time. And so they all went down there to watch. They went to watch Jimmy because they had heard about this kid. Then there he was, showing his steer. Judge would walk around as they would do. He looked, he began to look at the other calves, and the tension was growing, but it wasn't for Jimmy. Jimmy had worked so much with that calf stood like a statue. Just right there. He didn't have to do a thing. So the judge, he didn't know what he wanted to do, but he was struggling because there were two pretty good calves there. But then finally he had made his decision. As he began to walk to the calves, he put out his hand to shake the only hand that Jimmy had. Jimmy didn't know what to do, so he shook. He was the supreme champion of the fair. Everybody went crazy watching this. That calf just stood. You see, that's what animals do. That's what kids like. That's what you like as well. We have a connection with the animals. Now, that would be a great story if that was where the story ended. But it doesn't, because what happens at the county fair on the weekend after the show? We got to sell them. We're in business, right? We're in business. So here he was. Ladies and gentlemen,
the supreme champion of the Chowchilla Junior Fair, Mr. Jimmy Smith, and he had a big buckle. And he loved that buckle. He had more flowers on this calf than Secretariat had when he won the Triple Derby, or the Triple Crown. It was beautifully presented, and everybody was excited on this Saturday morning at the sale. Jimmy was standing there with his one good hand. Ladies and gentlemen, the supreme champion of the fair, the auction's on. How many dollars on it? Here, set on the money and go. I'm going to bid $1 there, I'm going to bid 2, 2, 3, 4 there, I'm going to bid 5, I'm going to bid 6, I'll 7 there, I'm going to bid 8, I'm going to bid 9. I'm in 9 here, 10 there, 15 to 20, the 5 there, we're going to go to 5, $30 a pound, the 5. Oh, man, things were getting excited. They were getting excited. Man, people were clapping. 35, now 40. I'm at 40 there, I'm going to bid 40, the 5 there, I'm going to bid 45, now 50. I'm at 45, now 50. And when the calf sold, it brought $52,000. In a town of 3,000 or 4,000 people. You see, the question becomes, though, and Oliver Espinola, a dairyman there in town, had bought the calf. But my question to you is this. Did Oliver buy a calf that day? No. Not in my mind. In my mind, what Oliver did is what a lot of you do all the time. You do it all the time by investing in our youth. He invested in the future of Jimmy to be a community asset instead of a community liability. When you want to talk about the future, what's the best way to create it? It's through our youth. And as a teacher, professor, you know, that makes it easy for me to say because I see it every day. But I know that's what you do as well. I've had the opportunity to speak at LEAD and work with the LEAD kids, and I've been up to Canada, the Canadian Angus Association, and work with their youth. There is your future. Right there, the articulate, bright young people in your association, and it's other associations as well. Let's make no bones about it. The other associations and the other species are doing a great job of working with kids as well. So if you want to know where the future of agriculture is going, all you have to do is look at your kids. Because isn't that what you do with your herd? What should be the best genetics in your herd? Your old cows or your young ones? Your young heifers. If you're doing your job right, genetically, each generation, you should be improving. And so if we're doing our job right, if we're really focused on the future, we're going to invest in our kids to make sure that we protect the future of American agriculture. Scott, I talked to some farmers and ranchers around the country and asked them, what do you think agriculture is to you? And Tim Zeber out of Minnesota says this, working with nature and all its challenges to provide food for yourself and others often requires sacrifices many others aren't willing to make for something, sometimes no more reward than the feeling of a job well done. No one's out there patting you on the back for having some of the best genetics in the world. No one's there every day saying, good job. How did they do that for you? Sometimes, you know, you'll see the return when you have your production sales and you're selling your bulls and your heifers. That's where you're going to see your return on your job well done. There'll be a return on that investment if you've been doing your job. Scott? Charles Waldman, who is a hog farmer up in Ohio, says it is fundamentally grounded in faith in the endless miracle of life springing from death. I trust that if I put this seed in the ground, all seeds of my family, all needs of my family will be met. Just think about the tremendous amount of faith it takes for you to do what you do, year after year, in face of escalating costs, escalating regulations. But you have a tremendous faith in being Angus breeders and producing the best quality product you know how to produce. And sometimes that's good enough. That's good enough because you know you've given it your best. Scott?